Welcome back. This is Robert Fleming, partner in the Tucson, Arizona elder law firm of Fleming & Curdy, PLC. The other partner, Elizabeth Noble Rawlings Freeman, is sitting across the console from me. Welcome back, Elizabeth.
Thanks, Robert.
I want to talk today about incentive trusts, Elizabeth. Let's start with definition of terms. What do we mean by incentive trusts?
Well, Robert, what we're talking about today is a type of trust where the whole goal is, by setting certain, I would say, goals, you are incentivizing, or the goal is to incentivize the beneficiary to do what you, who might be the person who established the trust, would like. And if the person is following those instructions, if the beneficiary is following the directions and is doing things a certain way, is incentivized to do those things, then the beneficiary probably get a distribution.
And we might add, sometimes incentivized not to do things that are bad.
Right.
And so incentive trusts very often, in the actual usage on the ground, as it were, tend to be about beneficiaries who have alcohol and drug or gambling or shopping problems. And maybe they're more esoteric. Maybe they're about religious affiliation or marital status or sexual preference or something else, but most often it's addiction that we're talking about, isn't it?
Robert, I think we see a fair number of those. I'm actually working on a trust right now. We're administering, so Fleming & Curdy is the trustee in this case, a trust where the goal is for the beneficiary to have education and follow certain directions around education and certain standards of living before the trustee can make distributions. So there's some incentive there for the beneficiary to go to school.
And that, I guess, particularly happens with grandchildren, because somebody who dies and has left a trust for children probably is of an age where their children have already either gotten their education or have gotten on in life without an education. So I guess I glossed over the grandchild education incentive trust, another big category.
Leading a productive lifestyle, that was a phrase in one of these trusts that I saw more recently. We see those phrases sometimes in trusts where the goal might be for the beneficiary to remain clean and sober, or the goal might be for the beneficiary to go to school. But the phrase productive lifestyle is something that sometimes we'll see. I couldn't begin to tell you, Robert, what I think the technical definition of productive lifestyle is. But what I would tell people is that if you're somebody who's thinking about creating a trust that has certain provisions because you want to encourage a beneficiary to stay clean and sober or to go to school, remember that when the rubber meets the road, the beneficiary simply might not be able to appreciate or have an interest in the distributions that you're hoping to encourage, that will hopefully encourage them to do something. So in some cases, we see beneficiaries who say, yep, I'm just not interested in following those guidelines.
The amount of money you're proposing to leave me isn't enough to make me completely change my view of the world.
Correct. And Robert, if we're working with somebody who is struggling with substance abuse, that person might not be able to really appreciate what it means to get clean. They might simply not be interested.
So Elizabeth, though, if you are the trustee of an incentive trust for either of the big issues, education or addiction, how do you manage the trust in a way that determines whether the beneficiary has satisfied the incentive goals?
Well, first of all, we have to look very carefully at the terms of the trust. And Robert, most of these trusts provide full discretion to the trustee to make a decision about whether or not a distribution can be made. So ultimately, it may come down to the trustee's discretion whether or not the beneficiary is leading a productive lifestyle or the beneficiary is of sound mind to get a distribution. I think what I consider when we're sitting with our case managers and talking about a case where there might be an incentive trust is, first of all, has anybody sat down or Zoomed with or called the beneficiary? Because we can look at trust terms all day long, and some of them are really detailed. Some of them are beautifully written and really optimistic. But the trust and the trust terms are really hard to apply unless you've gotten to know the beneficiary. So, Robert, that's one of my first and second steps, besides reviewing the terms of the trust, is to really make sure we've had a conversation and connection with the beneficiary so that we can all try and at least get on the same page about what the terms of the trust say.
I've had a number of conversations with beneficiaries that run to, this is what your mom or your grandmother, whoever it was, wanted to make sure that you would do before you got support or distributions from the trust. And the response is, they never understood what I was interested in and how I lived my life and what I think is important. And if I say, okay, that may be true, but here are the rules, the reaction is, yeah, but that was an unreasonable restriction that my mother placed. And it puts the trustee in an awkward place. But does it work, Elizabeth? When we have an incentive trust in the real world, does the incentive tend to work?
Robert, rarely does the incentive work in the way that somebody might have intended it when the trust was drafted. So I would say, generally speaking, they're very, very difficult to administer. And 9 times out of 10, not only will the beneficiary occasionally be offended, but the beneficiary might become really obstinate and not want to even make an effort to comply by the terms to get a distribution. So then, Robert, all of a sudden as trustee, we're in a scenario where we don't have engagement with the beneficiary, where we might be overseeing a trust where it's incredibly difficult to make a distribution for the beneficiary's benefit. So you're damned if you do and damned if you don't.
Have you ever administered a trust, Elizabeth, or been involved with a family member who's administering a trust that called for regular drug treatments or participation in AA meetings or NA meetings or something like that?
Robert, I have seen some of those trusts and been involved in the administration in some of those cases. What I'll tell you run into is HIPAA. So a trust could all day long say that the beneficiary has to test clean and attend X, Y, and Z kinds of appointments. Some of them might be medical. But if the beneficiary doesn't want to share his or her their healthcare information with us, it's really impossible to be able to follow through to prove that somebody was testing clean. And so these can be awkward to engage with the beneficiary about if the beneficiary does not want to release medical information.
One of the things that I occasionally see in what we might call incentive trusts, though, by the way, I've never seen a trust that had capital I incentive, capital T trust anywhere in the trust. So we're talking about a generic category. They're like blue trusts or tall trusts or something. But I've seen incentive trusts that that prohibit distributions unless something happens like a drug test or something like that. But seldom do I see the trustee being given broader discretion. And in my experience with family members, when they're trying to decide whether to support their child who has an addiction problem, for instance, they usually have not been quite so absolute. Well, there are some circumstances where, even though I don't approve of my son's lifestyle, I might be willing to come up with some funds to get him into treatment or to get him through a medical emergency, hoping that he'll get into treatment or something.
Or to pay for housing so that somebody is not on the street.
And the trustee doesn't often have that kind of discretion in a typical incentive trust, which I think is a little bit of a mistake by the settlor of the trust. They should be instead focusing on their selection of trustee and writing a letter to the trustee, that not a part of the trust, that says, here's what I would do in these facts, and I would like you to follow the same style that I have. I think we love to see those. Yes?
Robert, I think those are great, and those letters of intent can be helpful as long as they don't cause a conflict or some kind of ambiguity with the actual terms of the legal document.
And one of the nice things about the letter of intent is the trustee can share it if it's appropriate, but doesn't necessarily have to share it with the beneficiary, where the beneficiary is entitled to see the terms of the trust that affect them. So that's a lovely way to give some flexibility and some direction to your trustee. But the really hard part is selecting your trustee. We're going to talk, maybe next week, we'll talk about selecting the trustee for your special needs or incentive or other trust where discretion of the trustee is important. So what do you tell the client who says, I want to do something that you recognize that as an incentive trust, Elizabeth? Is it something you just resist doing, or tell them revisit this? Think about
it. I generally don't like drafting them, Robert. I'm not opposed to them when a client says that an incentive trust or describes what he or she might consider to be the terms of a trust that would be incentivizing the beneficiary. We normally have a conversation about that and why they want to see those terms in the document. We also, I really encourage them to be open and honest about what they think the beneficiary's interpretation of things will be. And it's not uncommon for somebody then at the end of an appointment to realize if the goal is to try and create stability for the beneficiary, you need to create a platform for the beneficiary to be successful, and creating really, really stringent terms around distributions and that kind of carrot and stick approach is really not effective for everybody.
I think that sage advice is where we'll end today. So you've been listening to Elizabeth Noble Rawlings Freeman, my partner, and me, Robert Fleming, from Fleming & Curdy PLC, a Tucson, Arizona elder law firm. This is Elder Law Issues. We'll be back next week. Join us then.